Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker. Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
What's up, fella?
Can't hear you. Can't hear me?
I got a pretty fair amount of money in there, and it's like I'm not worried about that little percentage and all that.
Yeah, it's hardly anything anyway.
Yeah, I mean.
Hello, hello, test.
Can you hear me? Hello, hello.
Yeah, I can hear you. You're pretty low.
Okay.
How do I sound?
Good.
Yeah, it's weird. You usually. Blowing the windows over here, but I can't. Go again.
Yeah, give me a second. I'm going to try to turn it up.
Okay. It'll be fine. We were just singing local bank praises. Oh, yeah. Today's new economy.
I haven't refinanced my house yet. My mortgage has gone up to another $400.
Yeah. Usually have a little scrap.
When we're not on the internet, he's like a little pencil. You know? I'm coming across the country, and I was pulling my trailer. I had been sitting, well, the tires were dead, and I had a tire go flat. So at Cookville, they have a Walmart, so I went in there and got the tire. I put it on my cart. I'm looking at these other cars. I'm like, and they're all. I need more. So I go to get the second one. I buy that one. And all of a sudden, I get this thing on Navy Fed.
Man.
That quick.
Yeah.
Hold on, I call them on.
Can you hear me now?
Hey, that sounds good.
So here's what we're going to do. I didn't do it last week because Dennis and I didn't get enough into the Iwo Jima stuff. But we have, we talked a lot about the landing craft and the Navy side, but we didn't get into the whole invasion aspect of it. So what I'm going to do tonight, you and I will talk the invasion stuff, but we don't have to worry about like going super long with it because I took that interview that I did with Robert Glenn, who served from Saipan all the way up to Iwo Jima, and I just cut out clips of his Iwo Jima experience. And so as we're talking about it, because we're not going to do this live, I'm going to go back tomorrow and insert his real-life remembrance of Iwo Jima as we're talking about it. And I think that'll give our show something different than any other podcast is doing Iwo Jima, because how many people have sat down with an Iwo Jima vet and got his firsthand account? So I'm going to, after we do the show, I'm going to listen to it tomorrow and in appropriate spots. I've already went last week and edited it down. I got 10 clips, each of them about a minute and a half. And so, you know, we don't have to worry about going a whole 120, because I got, you know, about 45 minutes worth of, or 30 minutes of worth of stuff we can interject in there. So as we're talking about it, I can fade into his remembrance of it, which I think will make for a cooler episode.
Yeah, I agree. And I was kind of going to suggest something along the same lines of, we can talk the invasion and all the stuff that, you know, people kind of already know, but I wanted to talk about those three specific Iwo Jima veterans that I had, you know, the opportunity to meet, and just kind of share those three experiences, you know, that people may not have heard.
Cool. So what we'll do is we'll kind of do the outline of Iwo Jima, the dates for the people who don't know. Plus, it's kind of cool that today, not only is today the 19th, but today is actually Monday the 19th. So it's like the day. It's like the actual day. And so we'll set all that up. Wow, this thing's super hot. Hello? Yeah, I'll turn my mic down. But yeah, so we'll you can talk about your vets. I can interlay stuff with Robert Glenn in there. I got to get rid of sound settings. Which one did that come out of? Oh, that came out of that one. I got to turn sound settings off on that machine. Sound settings. We do not want system settings on there. Hello? Cool. And, yeah, we go from there. And the 16th, I'm going to Bradenton to do a in-person interview. I'm going to take my two GoPros and set them up, and I'm trying to get Carrie to go with me. If she can't go, I'm going to ask Mike to go, to have somebody with a camera doing dynamic recording so that it's just not two static cameras, so that I can turn that into a video as well. So we'll have that content. And then I'm going to talk about the shirt later. The guy who actually brought this shirt back in existence, there's only 150 of them that exist right now.
Oh, wow.
He made them for a Marine Corps event that was being done. It was a, where's his, got too much shit open here. Where the hell did I put it? Must have had too much stuff. Oh, here we go. So he made these for a Cape Gloucester event that's being put on in Ohio.
Huh.
And these don't exist. You can't get, no one puts out reproduction version. Like if you type in World War II jungle sweater, you'll see the ones from Vietnam, like the thick vertical stuff and with the holes, like the modern day stuff. And he actually, I'm going to have him on a later show, so I'm not going to get all these details tonight, but him and his buddy went to the archives, got the original quartermaster's measurements for this, got a hold of Bronson Manufacturing, digitized it, got a hold of three real ones, sent them the real ones, and they made these to spec. Now, Bronson's going to release them next year, but they're going to be in modern sizes because these are original sizes. Like, the sleeves are a little short because that's the modern, that was the size of the day. But these are actually made for the jungle for the Marine Corps originally, so that in the winter time, you could wear them underneath your HBTs to keep warm because they're 100% wool. But yeah, and so cool thing about these is the Marauders wore them. Because they fought in Burma. And the Marauders, basically the Marauders could wear any uniform type they wanted to, but they wore these underneath an HBT jacket, pants. Like, they're only required to carry a certain gun, certain amount of ammo, but they could wear whatever pack they wanted. So if they liked the original, you know, haversack better, or if they wanted a musette bag, they could choose what, when it came to their gear, because they had to survive in it, in the jungle, they kind of got to choose what was available to them. But yeah, they're all, you'll see pictures of a few of them, because there's not a whole lot of Marauder photos. But yeah, these were actually issued to them, which I want to grab my book.
Yeah.
Actually see it right there.
Oh yeah. Wait, let me see the cover of that book. Oh, that's a Merrill's. Okay.
Yeah, Merrill's Marauders.
Yeah.
What distinguished, what made them different than like the Raiders is they actually had Indian troops and some Chinese troops in their ranks. Huh. So they took literally a mixture of different Allied troops and went and fought in Burma behind Japanese lines, and they used donkeys to haul all their gear. So once they got dropped in, they were basically on their own until the end of their missions.
Hey, so a couple of questions I've had for you for a while. I keep forgetting. Did you ever put these out on the website?
No, we never discussed the price or anything like that, so let me know on these. I don't know what our inventory is because I got to basically create. I mean, if you want to put them up on eBay and then we can put the link on our website, however you want to do it. I mean, it might make more sense for you to do it under your eBay since you have them in your possession.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, my eBay's not going to have, like, what's the scuttlebutt followers or anything.
Well, my eBay doesn't either, but I mean, I can put them, I'll put your eBay on our website.
Oh, yeah, if you want to, yeah, if you do that. I did change it to what's the scuttlebutt collectibles.
Yeah. Do me a favor, just put somewhere, like, in your about or whatever. Just put, you know, items sold on here do not fund our podcast or anything like that. You know,
right.
Just say these are collectible. These are items that we've had in our inventory, you know, that we just want to make, you know, we're making something like this be a little bit different. But, you know, that way people don't think, oh, wow, they're funding their podcast by selling their shit on the site. You know what I mean?
I know. Yeah.
But other than that, I have no problem with you using the name or the logo. Just put somewhere like under the about, you know, just put a little star, whatever, you know. These are just extras we have that, you know, or whatever. This by no way is, you know,
okay,
a funding source for our podcast or what we do.
Well, that's something. So I can just send it to you because, I mean, I can't edit it. I can send you what – or just edit it however you feel. I can't edit the website.
No, I'm talking about on your eBay, like, profile or whatever.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. I could probably do that.
Like, for example, if I go on my eBay.
Let me see.
Like, if I go to my eBay. I'm going to sign in. I mean, if you want, I could put them on my eBay just because I've been selling and buying stuff since 2001 and I have, like, a super high rating. I don't know if that means it, if you care. But, like, when I go to my eBay, like, when people go to sailor details, you can see, you can put an avatar and all that and all that up there.
That's
my eBay.
Dude. So, let's see. Let me do this.
So, here we go. Account settings. I mean, it really doesn't matter. No one's really going to go digging in and look. We'll worry about it later. Not a big deal. But, no, I mean, if you want to put them on your eBay, that's fine. I mean, you have them in your...
Okay. And then I'll just, whatever.
Or, I can put them on mine and then just send you the addresses or whatever, which is fine. Why don't we do that? Just because my eBay rating, like when people look at, you know, because a lot of times when people buy stuff, they want to know, is this, you know, can I trust the seller or whatever? I got a 341 rank right now.
Let's see. Yeah, I mean, I'm just starting out, but man, I'm moving stuff almost every day.
Cool. My history goes back to February 2003.
Yeah.
135 items sold. We got 100. I got 100% positive feedback. I wish I could use my eBay ranking for my credit score.
Yeah. Let's see. I don't know where I can. Oh, edit profile.
Yeah, just yeah. Well, you can just go.
Oh, in the about.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll just list them, and I'll put $10, and whatever sells, I'll just Venmo you half. How about that?
That's fine. Whatever.
I just not even try to do it through. I mean, I just thought it'd be cool, like for the listeners to specifically like.
No, that's cool. I just be honest with you.
I don't know.
Yeah, I've been so busy with all the insanity around here that, but yeah, no, I mean, you want to sell them, just, once you sell out of your inventory, just let me know and whatever, we'll go from there.
Yeah, I think I've only got like 8. I gave you one and I'm going to keep one.
Yep.
I think he made me 10.
Cool.
Well, okay, no big deal. And then the last question I had was, when do you want to do the other print giveaway?
I want to get... Let's do the end of March just so that we can get some more promotion out of it. Like when we did the first one, we had like four or five people sign up. But because we haven't done any new episodes with the exception of like two this year, no one, you know, we're not getting any. I'm guilty of this too. Let's shoot for March. I'll take photos of it. And I need to post it on Instagram and Facebook. We need to talk about it more. The whole intent is to get people to sign up. But since we haven't been putting on new shows and talking about it, it's kind of a giving it away. You know, that thing's like worth $400. I'd like to get a couple of subscribers out of the deal.
Well, maybe we use that for these for that instead of trying to sell them. Like maybe this is just swag. Like, hey, you know, the number one person gets the print, and number two maybe gets one of these or something.
Yeah, we can do that because I was telling Dennis last week that I don't think it's anything we're doing. I think it's the economy and people being strapped for cash. We were up to $80. We're back down to 68. So we lost like two subscribers. So so we went from $80 down to 68. So maybe the three of us can start whenever we're thinking about stuff, reading about stuff, pull out your phone, record a 2 or 3 minute video, send it to me so we can start posting that shit on Patreon. Because, I mean, yeah, people want to sign up for Patreon to support what we're doing, but they also kind of want the extra behind-the-scenes shit that's exclusive to them, which I don't, you know, none of us do. I used to do it when I first started, but, you know, we all just need to start. Yeah. We need to start just being a little bit more consistent with it.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, we have some people who happily sign up to support what we do, but I think there's people who want a little extra for their support. It sucks that we were down to $68. We were almost, when we were up to 80, I was covering the web hosting, and then the $20 a month I was making off of YouTube was covering the $14 a month I pay for Zoom. And so basically we were, you know, finally not costing anybody anything out of pocket, but now we're back down to $68. But
maybe like every couple days on like on social, showcase a different thing from the merch, a t-shirt. Hey, the spring is coming, get your tank tops, your tees, your women's tees, you know, and try to get more merch rolling too. Maybe
I just sent a hat to Poland. Well, I just ordered a hat for one of our patrons. Let's see. No, Germany.
What did McLennan? Did McLennan want a t-shirt or a hat?
T-shirt.
Okay.
I sent a hat to Germany. And then last week, I sent the shirt to Denmark.
Nice.
So we got a shirt in Denmark now and a hat on its way to Germany.
I need to look into the hat.
Because they were $7.50. I need to go on there and see if they have some new ones available, new styles available. Because at the time they were limited. It's been so damn cold. I was half tempted to go in there and order we have sweatshirts on there.
Yeah, I know.
And we have the big red logo sweatshirt on there.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I just sent out the hat and the t-shirt this week. And I sent out two t-shirts last 3 weeks ago. So this month I've spent about $100 on shirts and hats.
Well, and I'm going to still look into the place here in town about getting, you know, some stickers that when I go to events, try to sell some stickers and I can send you half of that or something too.
Well, if I would have got any damn tax return, I've been wanting to buy just a $200 color, a high-end color inkjet printer, because my Cricut makes, you know, like the little green ones, but I can do bigger ones. Instead of doing the vinyl stickers that take a little skill to put on, I can make.
Yeah.
Basically, what you do is you use the software, send the print job to a high-quality inkjet printer. You can't use laser because laser will melt the glue. And so you got to use a high-end inkjet printer, and then it prints it on the blank sticker sheet, and then you take the sticker sheet, put it in the Cricut, and it'll cut out around the shape. Actually, put the clear coat on it, then it'll cut out around the shape, not all the way through, and then you just cut them out, and they're exactly like regular stickers. So I can start making those, but I just got to get me a printer. The printer we had, the print heads clogged up on it, so I was able to do one print, and after that, it was like, so.
Oh, wow.
But anyhow, you ready to get started?
Yeah. Yeah, let's roll.
Cool. Yep. Obviously, we're not doing this live. And so if we do need to stop, pause, whatever, we can always go and cut it back out. Full screen.
Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. We're back for part two episode for Iwo Jima. Not only are we doing the part two episode for Iwo Jima, as Jeff and I were discussing before the show, not only is it the 19th, but it's actually Monday the 19th. It's like the day. If you're going to have an anniversary of a date, how cool is it to... Only thing cooler is if we would have got up this morning, which we couldn't make it work because Jeff's in a different time zone, but like if we would have kicked this bad boy off at 9 a.m. this morning, it's the only way closer we could have gotten it, possibly. Actually, no, the only way we could have done it was to do the backwards time zone math and figure out what time it would be at 9 a.m. in the Pacific and then do the show at that time. But seeing how we both work full-time, that's not an option. Welcome back, Jeff. How are you doing, fella?
Yeah, great, man. This is I really didn't want to miss last week in part one of Iwo. You know, it's one of my favorite things to talk about. We've got so many things to share with the listeners, but I'm glad to be here tonight. And I know Dennis was great last week for us, so I'm excited that you know, he's part of the team.
And Dennis is out this week because he's got the sniffles and he wants to get rid of his sniffles so that he's healthy for your and his close to face to face makeout session next week. So we got to make sure, you know, he wants to keep the creepy crud confined to within his household, and we respect him for that. So here's him getting better for your all's mandate next week, and you can all be in good health and good spirits for that. But
yeah, I think we're just going to. Every episode that's available of Masters of the Air, I tried to boycott and wait, and I don't think it's going to happen. I think we're going to watch them.
Yeah, I still think I might wait until they're all out and then binge watch them. He and I were talking last week. One of the things that I've been doing and what I suggest to the listeners, like who maybe just now getting into the Air Corps stuff and are just nipping, they want to stay in that realm, they want to get their fix. If you have Hulu, go revisit the remake of the movie Catch-22. It's based on the book. The book is written. The author did fly 60 missions. He was a bomber. The book is loosely based off of his experiences, but more it's based off of his deep, dark mind's paranoia of not wanting to fly these missions and dealing emotionally with the fact that it was 20, 25, 30, 35, 40. Mm-hmm. And how he basically it's based on true events, but it really goes off to a weird angle. So it's fictionalized with the characters and some of the craziness that happens, but it's kind of his way of getting that anxiety out. And the movie from the 70s is good. The first time I saw it at a World War II event on a projector on the side of a white trailer. And I got done watching that movie and I said, everybody on that cast must have been hopped up on cocaine because that was the craziest damn movie I've ever seen. It's just all over the place. And it's very, the special effects, like at some of the crazy parts at the time were way out there. The feeling, it kind of had some humor to it, which... And the movie is great, but kind of it made the whole storyline seem more far-fetched, whereas the modern-day version of it on the TV series that was directed by George Clooney, same storyline, a lot of the same dialogue, They added more seriousness to the scenes because you don't have Bob Newhart in it. You don't have some of the other people in it. And I don't want to upset people who love the movie. I think the TV show is a little more palatable for especially World War II historians who don't like fictional history. And so, but back to the point is they're in B-25 Mitchells, they're bombardiers. You get the scene of flat guns and the anxiety of what the guys felt seeing their mission counts go through the roof. And so if you want to experience that same Air Corps, but have the fun of a little craziness in a plot line, go on Hulu, watch, I think it's like 8 episodes of Catch-22, and you can kind of get a more interesting comedic yet crazy aspect of this author's idea of the war. I don't know. The only way.
Yeah, I thought it was a great series, to be honest, and I wanted more. And unfortunately, you know, when I met Kyle Chandler a couple months ago, I really wanted to talk to him about that, but it just wasn't the place and time.
He did a great job in that.
I agree.
I wanted to, after rewatching it, I wanted to go and watch the original movie because there's just so many people in it. And to see, perfect example, see Bob Newhart play these roles, or for those of you who grew up in the early 80s, to see Mr. Roper from Three's Company play in this movie. There's so many comedic actors and serious actors. And now that I've seen the movie, seen the series the second time, I kind of want to go back and watch the movie again because it's interesting to see what modern day actor plays the classic comedic actor from the original times. And I enjoyed it. I definitely liked it better the second time. But no, it's a great flick. The whole syndicate aspect of it is what I'm talking about when I say the crazy parts of it, the whole concept of the syndicate and what he's doing. But you know, the funny lines like major, who's a sergeant.
Yeah.
And the fact that they thought he was a major because his dad played a prank on his mom by naming him Major, and his last name was Major. And so he became a major just through mistake in paperwork, and then they didn't want to lose face, so they went ahead and promoted him to major. So then he was Major. So, you know, there's goofy comedic things like that in it. But yeah, check that out. Before we get to Iwo Jima real quick, as we always do, please head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Pick up a shirt like the one Jeff has. We have our Coffee Guy logo. We have back 5 or 6 years ago when like the X logos of different things were popular. We have the WTSP with two bayonets making the X logo. Go ahead and pre-order. Get your shirts for next Christmas with the Ralphie shirts. We have my personal favorites, the K-Ration shirts. We have the breakfast and lunch. I still need to get around to making the dinner one. So we have those with that classic box cover with the different color patterns on there. We have coffee mugs. Jeff loves them. I drink out of mine every day. It's 10-ounce coffee. I found out the hard way after setting it to 12-ounce on the Keurig. It's a 10-ounce coffee mug. Jeff, sometime this week, we got another item we're going to put up on Patreon. Speaking of Patreon, we talked about it last week. We do have, I think we're going to do this in March just because we're talking about doing it in February, but we've only done 2 new episodes this month. And so a lot of people are behind and they're not aware. So we want to give everybody plenty of time to become aware to go to WTSPWorldWar2.com, sign up for Patreon. Doesn't matter what plan you choose. And as long as you're an active subscriber, you'll be enlisted, if you will, or be eligible for this Valor Studio print. And this one is the Off the Line. This one is autographed by Henry Sledge. And as we were saying last week, these have been around a while, and these are actually out of the Sledge collection. They've been sitting at Henry Sledge's home and his home office for a few years now. So not only is it a great print, but they were, in fact, part of Henry Sledge's personal collection. So all you got to do is head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com, sign up for Patreon. We have 3 different tiers. One's a dollar. Second one's like, I think it's $1.50, $3.50, and $7.50. And as we discussed last week, you sign up for the $7.50 a month plan, and you are eligible for a t-shirt, or as Dennis and I decided, anything within value of a t-shirt. So if you want 2 coffee mugs, that's fine. If you want a hat, that's fine. Anything in our store that comes to equal or value of a premium shirt. Now, when we give away the shirt, I'm not lowballing you. I literally send you a link. Which shirt do you want? You tell me the size, the color, whether it's a premium, a girl, a female, whatever. So anything with the net value we'll send. I was just telling Jeff before the show, currently there's a hat on its way to Germany, and we sent a shirt to, what did I say, Denmark last week?
Yeah.
And so now our gear is getting to be international. And so sign up for the $7.50 a month plan and get you an item after second month. And that goes a long way to support what we do here. Now, trust me, we understand things are tough and times are hard with inflation. So if you want, you can simply support us by going to youtube.com, typing in D410 Media, and just watch our videos. You can watch all the What's the Scuttlebutt podcasts, some of our other World War II content, and that'll help support the cause. Exciting news. It's been a long time. We've talked about this a lot, how as time progresses, our opportunities, our privileges to interview World War II vets are getting few and far between. Shout out to longtime friend, fan of the show, been on the show. Big, sadly, he retired from World War II reenacting a few years back, but we know him as Cowboy. His name's Doyle. He sent me a message out of nowhere, say, hey, I got you, contact, call this guy. He's going to set you up with an interview. I'm going to go interview a World War II vet on the 16th of next month, so that'll be coming down the pipeline. Not only are we going to interview him audibly, but we're going to do some video. So that'll turn into a YouTube video as well. So make sure you go to youtube.com, look up D410 Media, and subscribe. And there's other content on our channel as well. So if you're into fishing, there's fishing content. There's other podcasts. There's fitness stuff. So there's plenty of stuff to be had on our content as well. And I think shirts, check. WTSP, check. Oh, shout out. Make sure if you haven't done this, go to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Click on the link for WLVM World War II Radio. He's a big supporter of what we do here. We got some stuff in the future coming up with him. He runs a great, great website, great radio station. We've talked about it in the past, but if you're new here, what they do is they stream in real time, quote unquote, just like a modern day radio station, but their entire content is real radio broadcast archives that he found. And so you turn it on and it's not just some playlist like Pandora. Every day is scheduled out just like a real radio station from midnight to midnight. They have 1940s era songs, commercials, sports broadcasts, news clips, everything. And so if you're really into the era and you have an event, or you just like myself, like to listen to it in background music at the office, and you don't like the Pandora ads or all that, and you want to hear music I guarantee you've never heard before, go to WTSPWorldWar2.com, click on the WLVM World War II radio link, fire that playlist up on your computer. You'll be happy that you did. And I think that's enough of that. That's a beautiful book you have behind you, Jeff, but I think we'll get to that during what you're reading. But let's kick off round two. We're going to do things a little different because every year, you know, we put out Iwo Jima content, but we're going to go a little different angle because we have the privilege of having interaction with World War II vets. And Jeff has had, with his past experience with the museum, he's had the privilege to talk to quite a few of them. So Jeff, take it away.
Yeah. Like you said, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's been said and reset about Iwo Jima. There's a lot of stuff that nobody will ever know about Iwo Jima. But you know, you and I weren't there, our listeners weren't there. So I thought, you know, what better way to really give the listeners something that they can't necessarily find in a book or in a movie. And that's just to share the experiences of the guys that did hit that beach 79 years ago today. And, you know, like I said, yeah, I've been fortunate to meet several Iwo Jima veterans. And I definitely wanted to be able to, you know, share some of those experiences with the listeners. And I guess first and foremost, I've got to talk a little bit about my old friend T. Fred Harvey. And, you know, he I'll be honest, you know, Jocko, if you go to his podcast, I forget which episode it was, but when Jocko had Fred Harvey on there, it was outstanding. And so definitely go check that out as well. Unfortunately, Mr. Harvey passed away more than a year ago now. But he really had a neat outlook on life in general. I mean, what that guy went through, I think he spent 9 days on the island before he was injured and woke up, you know, basically in the dead man room on a ship. He was so badly off. You know, for those 9 days, and that was his fourth campaign. You know, he wasn't fresh meat. He was a four campaign Marine at that time. And for him to have the kind of outlook in life that he did, and to go on and coach football and teach school and the life that he lived afterwards, really a testament to who he was. And to, you know, I got to see him just days before he passed away. We went down, brought the whole family, you know, to see him in the hospital. And there was one story that he really loved to share, even in his last days. And, well, there were several, I guess, but one that he really liked to share that I remember the most about him talking about was, and I'm trying to think of a good title for the story. It didn't really have a title, but it was really the promise he had to give to his mom, I guess is the best way to kind of title it. Don, you may have heard the story before, but I thought it was incredible. When he was leaving West Texas, the train stopped at this little train station somewhere there, right, you know, at his hometown, and he's going off, he's saying his goodbyes and everything, and he remembered you know, some of the girls that he knew at school that kind of really wouldn't give him the time of day. Now he's going off to join the Marines, and he said they're kissing him on the cheek and everything, and he said, you know, I was about to he's about to go over the hill right there and go AWOL with one of these girls. But, you know, so there's all this fanfare, and they're really sending the boys off in style in this little West Texas town. And he said, and all of a sudden somebody grabs him by the ear and takes him around the back of the corner of the train station there. And it was his mother. And he was very adamant to talk about how his mother was, you know, Comanche Indian. And I forget how many siblings he had, you know, quite a few. She was a pretty tough woman. And she made him promise a few things. And the first was that he was going to come home. Promise that you're going to make it, you know, and come home. And he said, yes, ma'am. And she said, and when you do come home, you're not going to be a drunkard. And he said, yes, ma'am. You're not going to come home and you're not going to be a coward. Yes, ma'am. And he said, and the last one, he said, that one really got me. He said, and she said, don't you come home with no tattoos. Of course, when he would tell the story, he was 97, 98. And he said, I still don't have any tattoos, you know.
Those were valid concerns, obviously not just because she's a mother. But you got to remember, his parents' generation lived through World War I. They saw what happened when people came home with the being a drunkard and, you know, undiagnosed, what they called, you know, combat fatigue or, you know, things like shell shock back then. And so she could have had brothers or cousins or guys that she had went to school with that she saw come back, and she didn't want her son to, you know, come back like they did.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he was the first veteran, a World War II veteran, that anytime he heard the term greatest generation, he said, I never really understood what that was about. He said, it was my parents. He said, they were the greatest generation to him. And I never really heard that really put into that perspective. But he said, if you know, like you said, it's the World War I, the Depression, you know, being a kid in the Depression is tough enough, but to think about it from their perspective, trying to feed 7, 8, 9 kids during the Depression. His take on the greatest generation was that, you know, it was his parents, you know, like you said, they lived through World War I. They were, you know, it's bad enough to be a kid growing up in the Depression, but to be a parent of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 kids trying to raise them and, you know, bring them up and give them a decent childhood during the Depression must have really been tough. And he credited, you know, anytime he heard the term the greatest generation, he always referred to that was his parents' generation. It just goes back to what I said at the beginning. The outlook that he had on life, you know, afterward, when he came so close to not coming home, really resonated with a lot of people. And he never met a stranger. And he was the biggest flirt. And he was still dancing and, you know, girls across the dance floor cutting a rug with him into his late 90s. It just... it's just really a testament to that particular Iwo Jima veteran that I just, you know, I love so much and I miss so much. And I'm just so proud that I got to share, you know, a lot of time with him and that he got to share, you know, these stories with me. It's just really, really special.
And it's really special to think that he was kind of in his sunset years, he was lucky enough and privileged enough not only to share his stories with people of all ages and locales, but he had that interaction and that relationship with different museums throughout the country, different, as you're saying, podcast hosts and people in the media. And so oftentimes, you know, when people who live through combat, a lot of people want to hear them retell the horrors, but when you're put into a situation like he often was, where he was kind of given his own dissertation or monologue or a one-man show, he got to choose what he wanted to talk about. And it sounded like he made sure to include a large percentage of the positive and the happier things that came out of the war. As we've talked about before, long before I had the podcast, when I was out doing a computer job at Fort Myers Beach, I was at an ice cream shop. There was a car parked out front, and I was done working, and a guy had a 1st Marine Division hat on, and I said, "When did you serve?" He's like, 1942 up to, I think he said, 44, and I said, "Oh, you were there at the beginning." He's like, "Yeah." I crouched down, and I said, were you in New Zealand?" And we spent 30 minutes not talking about fighting Japanese or campaigns. We sat there and talked about the New Zealand dock workers union strike and how they all had to get off the boats and offload all the boats and reload them during that bad weather. And he said, "Yeah, I remember the mounds of the frosted flake or the corn flakes and the delabeled cans." And we talked about, we didn't talk about anything combat, but his times in New Zealand and times in the war that he wasn't in combat. And what surprised him is I was like mid-30s at the time, here's some random 30-year-old in the mid-2000s who knew about the New Zealand dock worker strike and all the other things that happened during the war and not just the basic battles that the general public tend to know about, want to hear about, the nitty-gritty stuff. Here's a stranger reminding him of, quote-unquote, the good times of what happened over there instead of the horrible times. And so it's nice when the vets are involved in programs or put onto a program where the host knows enough that they're not quite so interested in forcing them to talk about the stuff that might bring up bad memories unless they instinctively go there in a conversation. It's nice to always have them to have the option to discuss what they want, good, bad, or indifferent.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I would say the second story that he always talked about, and again, even in his last few days that I saw him, he would ask several times. He said, "You know who taught me how to shave?" That's all he would keep asking me. "You know who taught me how to shave?" It was Tyrone Power, the actor, right? And it was one of those like goofy, funny stories that, yeah, we know, you know, this guy was at the foot of Suribachi for those whole 9 days, right? I mean, he was right at the foot of that mountain when the flag was raised and right there. I mean, right in, when we think of Iwo Jima, that was him, right? But that wasn't necessarily the stuff he would talk about. And it really, it's a story that really kind of highlights truly the youth of these guys. I mean, you picture, he's a 4-campaign Marine. He was a power Marine, right? So, you know, he went through jump school with IRAs.
Wow.
And he said, you know, he said, "Nice guy." I don't think he said 10 words the whole time I knew him. But, you know, this is a grizzled Marine veteran. And then he's talking about how the actor Tyrone Power and you know, as a Marine, taught Fred Harvey how to shave. Because, and if you've ever shaved, I know you have, in the same way I shave even today with the shave soap and a brush. It does take a little bit of getting used to as to if the soap is a little too thick or too watered. Mm-hmm. He said, "I never could get it right. It was running off my face," or it just, you know, he said, "I really couldn't get a good lather." And he said, "It was Tyrone Power that really showed me the, you know, really how to do it." And things like that. Because like you said, I mean, he could talk about being in that foxhole and these Japanese grenades come hissing in at him. And it was the third one that finally took him out and wounded him bad enough to be evacuated. And he could tell you about, you know, the sounds of a Nambu, you know, coming at you, you know, facing the business end of a Nambu in the jungles. And, you know, but he kind of always went to his mom, how important she was to him, who taught him to shave, and how when he was taken off the island, he was carrying his mother bought him that 1911. The Marine Corps did not issue him a 1911. They didn't even have a weapon for him. He was part of a demo team. So he was carrying a personally purchased 1911, and he never got it back.
Oh.
And he was real upset that he never found that thing after the war.
Oh, he was upset about losing another piece of item, too. You want to tell about that one? You're talking about how he went to jump school.
Oh, yeah. He pretty upset when they cut his jump boots off. Yeah.
For those of you who don't know, the Marine Corps Airborne Division had a very short life. Once the Marine Corps realized it really not a use for them in this theater, we have a large group of men that we could use elsewhere. Same thing they do with the Raiders after a certain point. Say, like, okay, Raiders are cool, but certain brass in the Marine Corps is like, well, technically all Marines are special forces. You know, they felt that, you know, what's so great about them? And so after a few key missions, they broke the Raiders up and just threw them in regular groups as well. And so at that time, the only thing that differentiated you from any other Marine was the boots, just like we saw in Band of Brothers, and how, you know, blousing your pant over your jump boots was a big thing because that separated you from the regular Army infantry. The Marines were that way, but even more, I would say, because they had such a short shelf life, which meant that they had a lower number of enlistments. And so, you know, you were few and far between. You were like, you know, when you walked by in those boots, people noticed. And to want to have those when you went home, but rightfully so, some careless doctor who was more concerned about your life, not your wardrobe, cut them off and threw them in a stack in a corner of a boat along with 38 to 140 other pair of boondockers. You know?
Yeah.
He was like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll miss Mr. Fred Harvey. And for those listening, you know, buy his book, Hell Yes, I'd Do It Again. It's a great read. It's one that even, you know, my wife read. To really kind of get to the heart of who Fred Harvey was. And, you know, just like I said, I can't say enough how proud I was to get to know him and spend some time with him for sure.
Great man. And I had the privilege. He spoke at the museum when I was out there. So I got to hear him tell those tales in front of the audience in real time and hear his telling of his boots. And got to sit down and have lunch with him and his granddaughters.
Yeah.
And great guy. Very privileged to have had the opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess, you know, the next that takes me to I guess we'll do Herschel Woody Williams.
Okay.
Now I got to meet him several times. Did a couple events for some speaking engagements that he was at. But one engagement really stood out to me for a number of reasons. And one, it's because he, for the first time, he talked about something besides Iwo Jima, which that's what I was interested in because I'd heard one of his speeches before. The guy's a Medal of Honor recipient. At the time, he was the last living Medal of Honor recipient from the Pacific Theater for the U.S. So, I mean, kind of a big deal. Everybody wants to know about him and a flamethrower and Iwo Jima. But at this one particular event, which ironically enough was an Iwo Jima reunion, he talked about his time on Guam with the 3rd Marine Division and the first time that he took a man's life. You know, Woody was not a flamethrower operator. And, you know, as you get to know his story, it becomes more incredible that that was the fact. He was a rifleman. He was a rifleman with initiative. But he's on
and a strong
Guam
back.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those things are not light.
No, no. About 70, 72 pounds. So, yeah, it's a heavy weapon system to volunteer to have something that volatile on your back. But, you know, as a rifleman, he, I believe he had a Garand on Guam, and he talked about that. And I thought that was interesting for him to bring it up because it made everything else a little bit more, I guess, a little bit more real. Not that the flamethrower story isn't so unreal, but it, I guess because it's what we all expected. Oh, here's the Medal of Honor recipient, Woody Williams. Here he is. Let's talk about flamethrowers. To hear his story about the first time he took a man's life was, you know, kind of eye opening, and it really put into perspective, you know, what he went through, because I don't think we always think about that. When we have somebody that we, you know, we treat as this hero, this national treasure, we don't think about those little personal struggles. And it was, like I said, it was just very, very interesting, very eye-opening to hear about what happened on Guam, you know, before anybody really, you know, knew his name like we know now. So I thought that was interesting. And that was that same night that, you know, you have different events. They've got little raffle tickets, and you try to win stuff, right? Like, you never, I never win that kind of stuff. But they had several Woody Williams items up there on this table for the raffle, and all autographed, of course. And I bought one raffle ticket, one, and that one raffle ticket was drawn for this nice little bust wow. here of Woody.
That's cool.
When he. Yeah, super cool, and he signed along the bottom here. Of course, I had other things with me for him to sign, but, you know, it's an interesting story, too, beyond his Medal of Honor, beyond flamethrowers, beyond Iwo Jima, was how he started the Gold Star Family Foundation. And, you know, that was some of that was the reason for some of the other times I got to meet him was a groundbreaking ceremony for the Gold Star, the statue that they would make. You know, they would put it different places all over the U.S. And it was because when he initially tried to join the Marine Corps, he was too short. He was turned down beginning of the war. He was actually turned down. And he was delivering Western Unions.
Wow.
And he grew up, I believe, in, I want to say it was West Virginia. But, you know, we can look that up later. But I want to say it was West Virginia. He delivered a Western Union. One of those Western Unions.
Yeah, that's now.
And
for those of you new to this whole thing, you're just getting into the subject matter. You're not aware. Western Union was the number one form of communication from the military, all branches, to the families of those who perished or were missing during the war. And so Woody tried to join the Marine Corps. It was too short. His contribution to the war effort was sadly delivering Western Unions. And by this point in the war, no one wanted to see you. If you're a Western Union guy and you're coming down the sidewalk, moms, fathers, sisters, they all held their breath and hoped and prayed that you just ride on by and go to somewhere else. And so
right.
to see the looks on people's faces as you walked up to their front porch or rode up on your bike or car, whatever his mode of transportation was, that could not have been, that had to be hard. I'm sure he took pride in the fact that, you know, or solace in the fact that he's delivering much needed, much required news, but I'm sure that's not something that you were, you know, super excited to do on a daily basis, but it had to be done. I'm sure there's some pride there, but seeing the reactions to people and their faces drop, tears coming down. I'm sure a lot of people literally falling to their knees and crying just by your presence. That had to be hard. Had to be hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And this particular one is kind of what spawned his idea even before he joined the Marine Corps, because at the time there was the Gold Star Mothers, right? You know, everybody, any service member from your family that was overseas, they would hang a blue star. And of course, if they were killed in action, then you would get a gold star to hang in your window just to show, you know, the service that your family has given to the country. Well, he delivered this one telegram in West Virginia to a father. who lost his son. And I guess the mother was deceased or whatever. But the father, with tears in his eyes, said, you know, dads cry too. And it kind of resonated with Woody that it's not just the mothers that lose a son. It's not just gold star mothers. There's such a thing as gold star fathers and uncles and aunts and brothers and sisters. So he started the Gold Star Family Foundation, which, you know, you can look a lot more into. Just a really, really neat organization. And again, sadly, Woody Williams is no longer with us. And again, very lucky to have talked with him one-on-one. And, you know, that same evening that he talked about his time on Guam and that I won this little bust here was also the day that we handed him a flamethrower in a Holiday Inn parking lot and demonstrated it for the public with the fire marshal there and the fire truck. And I know I've talked about that a few times, and we may do a recording of that for maybe for Patreon subscribers to hear the whole story because it was a doozy. But again, we'll miss Woody as well. This another Iwo Jima veteran and that I've had the opportunity to meet. And the last one I'd like to talk about, and Don, I'm not sure if you've ever got to meet this particular one or not. He's still around, and his name is Don Graves. And Don Graves is not, of course, not nearly as famous as Woody Williams, but the interesting thing about Don is that Don actually was an assigned flamethrower operator on Iwo Jima and is the last one alive. So even though Woody becomes famous because of a flamethrower, he wasn't a trained operator. He was a rifleman. Don actually was a flamethrower operator. So really, of course, he's got some interesting stories. And there is a picture of him, a very famous picture of him in several books on Iwo Jima, but he is not captioned. It came out years after the war that he recognized himself, but a lot of stuff is that's not captioned as him. What makes Don
Graves? Hold on, you're breaking up. Give it a second. Now, let me point out the life expectancy of a flamethrower operator in combat during World War II, 5 minutes. Which is why Woody would have been a rifleman who was given a flamethrower, because the life expectancy, that meant that the other flamethrower operators who were on that beach that day or that island that day were no longer around, and they needed someone to fill that void, and that's how he was assigned the job. Go ahead, Jeff.
Right. Yeah, so what makes Don Graves' story so great is not necessarily what he did on Iwo Jima, but how he dealt with it coming home. It's really a great story of him finding God, finding himself, several broken marriages, a whole lot of alcohol later, and he finds himself basically becoming a preacher for I forget how many decades, just really devoted himself to God, because he said when he was on Iwo and as he's hunkered down against the black sand, he was so scared. He said he never prayed like that before, but he said, I prayed to God, and if you let me live through this, I will serve you the rest of my life. And he said he grew up, again, Depression era, very poor. He said we didn't go to church much because we couldn't afford clothes or shoes to go to church. He said we didn't have Sunday best, so he just kind of didn't go, and he didn't really have a use for God until that day on Iwo Jima. And then when he comes home, he totally forgets about this deal that he made with God for quite a few years. I want to say it was well into the 1950s when his life was really just down in the dumps, spiraling out of control, had nothing left, and got to the end of the bottle before he finally started turning his life around. Now, when you meet him in at different events and or in the you know, hospitality suite of the hotel, you'd never know that this guy went through some of the most horrific combat in the Pacific in World War II.
And, you know, kind of when we were growing up, we never looked at the old people, even though they're in their 50s at the time. You would have never known walking through a grocery store, right, the guy yelling at you from down the street. You know, perfect example of that. I was in middle school in 1992. And I can remember Park Street Elementary, Grove City, Ohio, no longer there. They tore it down because it was an old building full of asbestos. One of my classes used to sit on the second floor facing the main street. Didn't know anything about it back then because I was just a punk kid in seventh grade. Thinking about it now, it breaks my heart. Every day around 11 o'clock, there'd be a quote-unquote old man, at least to us, old, of course, when you're in seventh grade, 30-year-olds are old, guy walking down the street, broom slung over his shoulder. We just thought he was a crazy guy with a broom. Looking back on it now, no, he was doing his parade march with his rifle slung over his shoulder as he marched up and down the street, reliving those days. You know, to us, little a-holes in middle school, we're all laughing. Look at the weird guy with the broom on his shoulder walking up down the street twice a day. But, you know, it's crazy what you don't know when you don't know it. And even if someone tried to say, hey, little jerks, knock it off, the guy's a vet at that age, you know, it wouldn't have made a difference. But just because we're on a subject has nothing to do with the Pacific, but it is World War II. And, of course, at the time, I didn't know any better. Don't know how my middle school principal had a relationship with the Prince of Belgium at the time, 1993. And he was in the United States on a diplomatic thing. He came to our school and was talking about Belgium and World War II and how did that, to this day, 1993, the people of Belgium still celebrate the Allies and what they did to liberate them. Of course, once again, back then, we got to sit through and listen to this. God, I would love to, as now being my age, I've been sitting in that room and interacting with him. But back then it never occurred to me. I forgot all about it. It's like, oh, well, yeah, the active Prince of Belgium in 1993 came and talked at our school about World War II. But once again, it just flew over your head at those times. And I can remember living in Kentucky in the 80s. I was too young, but my brother was older. They had concentration camp survivors come talk to the fifth and sixth graders in history class and show their tattoos and the whole thing. But they try to make an impact on younger kids. But I think stuff like that, it's good to share with middle schoolers, but I think it's probably more effective with high schoolers just because they're a little more mature. Even still, a large population of them would not care, but the smaller population who do care and pay attention, it would have a more impact because they're more mature to know about the subject matter, whereas middle school's a little early. But yeah, just one of the things that comes with age. Well, I appreciate you sharing those stories with us. Before we go to the finalization of this episode, where we're going to play some clips that comes from a previous episode, but I thought it'd be perfect. Sadly, the aforementioned cowboy reached out to me and let me know that, because he's the one who recommended Mr. Robert Glenn, who fought in Bougainville, Guam, and on Iwo Jima, that sadly he passed away 2 years ago of COVID. But from episode 81, we're not going to play the whole thing, I've isolated his experience on Iwo Jima, and I've gone as far as removing myself. So you're going to hear segments, and I've kind of done it in a way where the segments are self-explanatory. But I thought it'd kind of be cooler and more impactful for him just to tell his memories and what happened to him on the island without my interference, without my interjections and my questions. And so before we go into that, we do want to hear from each and every one of you. So send us emails at mail@wtspworldwar2.com. Jeff, you have a beautiful book displayed behind you, as you always do. I know that's more for the episode tonight, and not so much but what you're reading, but what are you reading recently?
Well, it's funny you talk about the classroom environment and how to get you know, students and young people involved in World War II. Kind of a perfect segue to what I am reading, and that's called "The Things Our Fathers Saw." This is volume two now. I finished volume one, which is all about boys that served in the Pacific. Volume two and then volume three is about the war in the air. But if you're not familiar with Matthew Rozell and this series, I believe there's nine books that my beautiful wife got for me for Christmas. And even though I'm stacked up with college books I really need to be reading, I always find the time to read a little bit of this each night, because it's very well done, because it's the stories of the guys that this particular history teacher had the foresight to interview, to bring to his classroom and then record, or assign his students to find certain individuals, certain veterans, and get their story. And then it's just all been compiled. So the author doesn't interject very much. It's a lot like an interview, like what we do, like what Don does here for the podcast. So that's how it reads. It's kind of italics, the author, this and that, and then the veteran tells his story. And then it's just compiled beautifully by Matthew Rozell. So The Things Our Father Saw, it's what I'm reading. It's what I'm going to be reading for quite some time, the entire series. And go check it out. I do believe they are going to make, I don't know if they're going to do a series or a movie about it, but I've heard there's something coming for, you know, from the video aspect on that series. So excited about that.
You know, that is the nice thing about when major series such as Band of Brothers or The Pacific, or in this case Masters of the Air, comes out and it regenerates or builds new interest from a newer generation in World War II. And those projects do well. That shows the people in charge of putting out productions and investing money in productions that, hey, World War II is viable again as a commercial property. Let's start funding some of these projects that we've, you know, bought claims to, or that's been sitting on the shelf because, you know, these screenplays or storylines or these books that have been optioned, you know, the interest is there again. So let's, and so anytime a series comes out that reignites interest, you'll see, maybe not on the same scale, but you'll see more projects coming out in that three, five year period on World War II and the like. And so hopefully, if Masters of the Air does as well as everybody's hoping, we'll see more of these smaller